If you go down today to the rural communities that surround the Fulton game area and ask someone about the murders that took place there, more likely than not, people will tell you about how they always knew that Jeff Titus had done it. About how everyone had always known that Jeff Titus had done it. And that it just took the cops a little while to get the case together.
What do you think makes Jeff seem guilty to you?
Well, his alibi obviously completely fell apart, and I don't know a lot of the details of it. I know a lot of people in the community that knew that he was kind of crazy and very protective of his land. So it seems likely to me, and everything fit for me in my head.
Like I said, I know that dude didn't like Doug being where he was hunting. He called it his corner of the property.
Who'd you hear that from?
A mutual friend that lives in Memphis.
Okay.
Yeah, he told me about all this after the fact. I didn't know about all this, but he's the one that told me about all the gunshots and all that stuff that had been going on for years out there, warning people to stay out of there.
Gary Kremble is one of the few people who knew both of the victims in this case. He was Doug Estes' cousin, and he happened to know Bennett from seeing him around at the local bars. And he, too, says that he always knew the killer was Jeff Titus.
Actually, well, we had the feeling that Titus was the one.
How'd you get the feeling?
Because we just knew. We knew it.
But you didn't know him. It seems like someone must have told you.
No, I didn't know him, but I just got a good judge of how people that are territorial and their land backs up. Who in the hell else could have been?
Skeeter Cerny, a family friend of the Bennetts, also remembers hearing all about the territorial landowner who'd finally lost it and killed two men on the public game land.
That's the way it sounded to me, because he was pissed. The way I understand it, he was pissed at where he hunted. People were going in there and screwing up his hunting, and he just got tired of it and went nuts and shot him.
Reading through the original police reports, though, this idea that everyone always knew Jeff Titus was the one who committed the murders seems to be something of a revisionist history of events. Because for one thing, aside from the people around Fulton who knew Jeff Titus personally, most of the witnesses who knew Jim Bennett and Doug Estes had never even heard of Jeff before his arrest in 2001.
Had you ever heard of him, though, like this guy?
Never heard of him. I don't even know his name now. What was his name?
Titus. Jeff Titus.
Don't ring a bell. No.
Yeah. Did anyone call in about Titus?
Never.
Oh, really?
No one ever talked to me about Titus, ever.
Rumor may say that everyone always knew that Jeff Titus had committed this crime, but those rumors have often strayed far from the truth. And in this case, the rumors say a lot of other things, too. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 8 of The State versus Jeff Titus. My name is Rabia Jadhri. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, A Non-Story. And I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. It's not that there weren't people who were suspicious of Jeff Titus in the days and weeks following the murders. There were. As one of Detective Racima's reports notes, quote, Jeff Titus has been eliminated by alibi and polygraph, although numerous people do call with information that he is an extremely weird subject. These tips were called into the Silent Observer, which is Kalamazoo County's tip line program. It's basically the same as Crime Stoppers, which is the name the program goes by in Baltimore. But overwhelmingly, these tips were not coming from Fulton, where Titus lived, or Leonidas, where Jim Bennett was from, or any of the surrounding rural towns down there in that area. They were being called in by Jeff Titus's co-workers at the Veterans Affairs Hospital in Battle Creek, or else from people who knew Jeff Titus' co-workers at the VA and heard about him from them. These tips said things like, regarding two hunters found shot to death, caller is ex-employee of VA Medical Center, where Jeff Titus, the one who found the weapon, worked. She stated that Jeff Titus is a strange character, may possibly be involved. Or there's this tip, Silent Observer tip number 4032. Informant advised that Titus worked at the VA hospital in Battle Creek. He is very emotionally deficient in some areas. Or then there's this one. White female who did not want to give her name called. She stated that she worked with Titus several years ago. After reading the newspaper and seeing Jeff Titus's name, she thought it must be him. Over the years, though, rumors about Jeff Titus did begin to circulate around the rural communities south of Battle Creek in Kalamazoo. Especially once the cold case team began its investigation and Jeff Titus was identified as their primary suspect. Some of the more common rumors didn't mention Jeff Titus by name. There was talk about a territorial landowner who'd been a problem in the Fulton game area for years before he finally snapped and committed the murders. These rumors are generally assumed to be about Jeff Titus. Or at least, they're assumed to be about Titus now anyway. And maybe they really were. But Jeff Titus had only moved into the farm that bordered the game area a few months before the murders happened. It's not possible that he'd been causing problems at the game area in the years before that.
A lot of the rumors going around about Jeff Titus have to do with what exactly led to him finally being arrested 11 years after Jim Bennett and Doug Estes had been killed. For instance, from what Skeeter Cerny has heard, investigators were finally able to arrest Jeff Titus because he'd gotten caught admitting that he'd done the crime.
Oh, it was in the bar in Athens he was bragging about doing this.
So you've heard he bragged at a bar?
In Athens, yes.
Would that be the office, I guess? I don't know.
Right.
There's only
right.
one bar.
Yep. It's still called that, I don't know.
If he did...
Someone heard it.
If he did, no one ever told the police.
There was a lot of rumors going around. Well, God only knows.
I'm wondering if it was Titus they were talking about, or if it was someone else.
Yeah, it was Titus.
Are you sure?
Okay. Sure. I mean, they said his name, Titus.
This rumor about Jeff Titus having confessed to the murders at a bar is one that Jacinda and I heard a lot, though the details of it often varied. Sometimes it was said that Jeff had made his confession at a bar called The Office in Athens, while others recall it taking place at the Thunder Hog, the local watering hole in Leonidas. Gary Krimble, Doug Estes' cousin, has heard all the same talk as well, though Gary Krimble does not believe that these particular rumors about Jeff Titus are true.
So Skeeter remembers hearing stuff around the bars, like people who, you know, just talking and stuff.
Yeah, I think that all that was just freaking talk. Because I don't think Titus, I never seen Titus in that bar, not one time.
I've heard stories about someone confessing in a bar. I don't know if you ever heard anything like that.
You know, there's always somebody confessing to something they never did because they're just losers and they want attention.
Gary Krimble is right. He wouldn't have ever seen Jeff Titus at the bar. Jeff Titus didn't go to bars and wasn't really much of a drinker in general. So, if there was someone confessing into the murders at a bar, well, it was not Jeff Titus. There's another rumor, though, that I'm even more curious about. It came from a friend of Jim Bennett's who'd once bartended down at the Thunder Hog. And it was the kind of rumor that the man hadn't realized was a rumor at all. He'd been under the impression that it was a well-established fact of the case. That farmer, he told us, the one who was convicted of killing Jim and the other hunter... Well, it turned out that it had been his son who'd gone to the bar and confessed to the murders on the very day that they happened. Except Jeff Titus doesn't have a son. He does have two daughters, but they were 7 and 4 years old when this crime occurred. So it seems reasonably unlikely anyway that either of them would have been down at the bar that night, whether confessing to murders or otherwise.
Another common rumor about Jeff Titus is that he was finally arrested for the murders because his wife had decided to leave him, and in order to do so, she turned him in for the crime.
All I know is that his wife was his alibi for all those years, and then apparently they went their separate ways and she turned him in, is what I'm understanding.
Julie Titus did not turn in her husband for murder. She was never even interviewed until late in the cold case team's investigation. And when she was finally interviewed, nothing Julie Titus had to say was helpful to the prosecution's case. She corroborated Jeff's statements and expressed no doubt in his innocence. Although the Titus' marriage had been strained at times, there's no evidence whatsoever that it was in any way attributable to the murders or because of Julie Titus' involvement in any sort of cover-up. And in her testimony at Jeff's trial, the only complaint that she made about her husband came up when she was asked if she described her husband as having a tendency to talk too much. "Oh yeah," she said. "The girls and I used to get upset with him because we'd be waiting and check out at Meijer's or Kohl's and he would turn around to the person in back of us and just strike up a conversation. Yeah, he likes to talk." The origins of a lot of rumors about Jeff Titus are opaque. But some of these rumors have a very clear source. They're coming from Jeff himself. That was the case about one of the early tips called in about Jeff Titus that was neither from the Fulton area nor from Titus's co-workers at the VA. It was from a man named Dan Israels, who called the sheriff's office 2 weeks after the murders to report a suspicious conversation that he'd had with someone while out at Fort Custer. He'd been out there with his father and girlfriend to attend a special hunt being held there, and while waiting in line to check in, he had talked to a man. Dan Israels had not known the man personally, but he did recognize him as Jeff Titus from seeing his picture in the local paper, in the article about how Jeff had found the missing shotgun. Israels described Jeff Titus as being a cocky guy who talked about how he had a block permit that let him shoot lots of deer. And Israels could see that in the back of Titus's truck, he had 5 doe and 2 buckheads that he was bringing in to register. But when Jeff had begun to talk about the murders at the game area, Dan Israels found the things he was saying to be odd and alarming. For one thing, Jeff told him that he'd found the missing shotgun 41 yards from the bodies, but according to the newspaper, the gun was only 21 feet away. Jeff also said the shooting had been drug-related and that he'd heard gunshots at 4:30 p.m. that afternoon. And in describing the crime, his story was not consistent about the kind of gun that was involved. He mentioned 3 different kinds of weapons, a double barrel, a pump action shotgun, and a muzzle loader. At Jeff's trial, Dan Israels testified that Titus had not exactly been bragging at the time, but that he had also not been holding back about the fact that the murders had happened not far from his property, which Israels found to be strange. Israels also found it strange that Titus was, quote, even talking about it and specifically stating certain things that happened at the scene. In other words, Titus seemed to know specific details about how the crime was committed, like how both victims had been shot in the back.
The cold case team found Dan Israels' testimony about this conversation at Fort Custer to be significant evidence against Jeff Titus. Though, I'll admit I struggle to see it that way. Dan Israels had thought it suspicious that Titus was giving him incorrect information about the crime, saying that the gun had been found 41 yards away instead of the 21 feet away that the paper said. But the thing is, Titus was right about this. It was the newspaper that had gotten the facts wrong. And although Dan Israels had been confused by Titus mentioning 3 different kinds of guns, from context, that also makes sense to me. The muzzleloader and the pump action were the victim's shotguns, and the double barrel sounds like Titus speculating in the same way that Detectives Ballett and Worsema do, when talking about possible reasons for why no fresh shotgun shells were found at the crime scene.
If you're using a pump shotgun, the first shell is going to be ejected when you rack it back for the second shot. At that point, that second shell can stay in the chamber, but you'd have to pick up the first shell that got ejected after that first shot. Otherwise, the scenario was kicked around along with all the other hearsay and various other things that had floated around, that somebody used a double barrel shotgun.
With a pump shotgun, if you fire 2 shots, you'll necessarily eject at least 1 casing. But with a double barrel shotgun, it would be possible to fire 2 shots and not have any casings be ejected. There is a part of Dan Israels' story, though, that would be incriminating for Jeff Titus. According to Israels, Jeff Titus told him that he'd heard the gunshots that afternoon at about 4:30. And if true, that would destroy Jeff's alibi, because at 4:30, Jeff says he was up at the Shepherd Farm north of Battle Creek, not at his own farm.
But his testimony at your trial, was that accurate about what you said? That you told him that you'd heard the gunshots at like 4:30?
No, I didn't hear them. They said the gunshots were around 4:30. I wasn't there.
But you knew the gunshots were around 4:30 at the time?
That's what the report said, and it was said to me.
As Jeff Titus remembers it, his conversation with Dan Israels had been innocuous. People had been asking him about the murders, as they often did, so he told them the stuff he knew about it. That was it. But if that was really all it was, then why would Dan Israels have felt compelled to report this conversation to the police? Israels didn't know Titus. He had no reason to lie or to want to get Titus in trouble. So what made him think this was something he needed to tell the police about? Well, there were other witnesses to this conversation out at Fort Custer who may be able to shed some light in that.
He said he did go around saying, "I found the gun, but the cops couldn't."
Yeah. That probably was one of the worst mistakes he made, because he did that out. We were hunting government property.
Uh-huh.
And he did that while we were all standing in line. And there was a couple people that testified against him.
Oh, you were there when Dan Israels?
Mm-hmm. Myself, my dad, and Jeff, and we were all standing in line.
That's Kelly Warren, the daughter of Jeff Titus' friend, Big Jack Warren.
We weren't actually with him. We ran into him out there, and then he just stood in line with us. And my dad knew quite a few of the people that were there and was talking to different people. So, but that couple, it was real obvious that Jeff offended them or bothered them by what he was saying about that if the cops really had walked hand in hand, like they said, and walked along through there, that there's no reason why they should have missed that gun. And my dad tried to get him to stop talking about it because you could see that they were upset about the situation, the conversation, and that's why I say it was Jeff just being bragged. He was bragging about it, yeah.
Did he realize that the people were upset, or is he just...
I don't know. Sometimes he seemed oblivious to stuff like that.
Kelly Warren doesn't remember Jeff Titus saying anything that day that, in her view, was incriminating. She doesn't remember Titus saying anything that would have led her to believe he was involved in the crime. But what she does remember is Jeff Titus making things uncomfortable by refusing to change the topic of conversation, even when to her it seemed obvious that he should have. When Jeff Titus found Doug Estes' shotgun, he'd attracted a lot of suspicion his way. But even before that, before he'd come up with a missing gun, there were some people involved in the case that had been suspicious of him. People like Bobby Brown, the stepson of Doug Estes, who'd been out hunting with him that day and ended up being the person to find the bodies. The first time that Bobby Brown had met Jeff Titus had been the day after the murders. Bobby had gone back to the crime scene with the detectives in order to go through the prior day's events with them and to show them where everyone had been. And to get into the game area, they'd cut across through Titus's fields.
The second day, when they took me out there and I seen him raking his yard like that, I remember that was the first time I seen him. He was standing out there raking his yard with a 44 on his side with his two little girls. I remember saying to the cops that, "You don't find that odd? Raking his yard with his two little girls and he needs a sidearm?"
There had been a murder, like, just over the hill, though.
Yeah. I don't think I would have been out breaking the yard with a sidearm. I just wouldn't have went outside.
When Bobby Brown first saw Titus, he'd immediately thought he'd seemed odd and suspicious. Why was he outside with his two little girls when a double homicide had happened so close by just the day before? And why was he armed like that?
The next night, the police brought the stepson back, and they stopped at my house, and I was there in my yard, and I was wearing a pistol. And he said, "We had a big old cannon strapped to his hip." Well, it was a .357. And I wore that after that because I never knew, like I said, you didn't know who shot him, what was going on, and for my own protection and my family, I went around with a gun on me. And I had a gun in each of the barns. But if somebody come, I had a place where I could go to defend myself.
Bobby Brown isn't the only person who thought it odd that Titus went around armed after the murders. But every time this has come up, I found myself wondering if maybe there was something else going on here that people aren't quite able to articulate. Something else that was causing them to perceive Jeff Titus as suspicious or odd. Maybe something about the way that he wore the gun or his demeanor, I'm not sure. Because Michigan is an open carry state, and the case file describes other people carrying pistols like the one Titus had about the game area without causing apparent alarm. Because I'll admit, I'm not used to hearing folks out in the country express alarm about someone being armed, especially when a double homicide has just occurred nearby. Or maybe what made Titus strange to folks is that he was alarmed by the killings. Because not all of Titus' neighbors seem to have been particularly bothered by the shootings. In January of 1991, the Kalamazoo Gazette ran an article that quoted neighbors who lived in the area, including Jeff Titus, about their reaction to the recent murders.
Titus said that since the shooting deaths, he never enters the woods without a gun at his side. The people I hear are edgy, and I think it'll put a lot of people at ease when they catch the person who did this, Titus said. Right now, who knows what to expect? They were local, was it planned or what? But Clarence Jones, who owns and operates the salvage yard at his East X Avenue property adjacent to the scene of the killings, said the incident had not left him uneasy. I lived out here about 27 years, and nothing like that ever happened before this. Things like that happen in the world, and I think it was two people more or less in the wrong place at the wrong time, Jones said.
Clarence Jones passed away a few years ago now, so I wasn't able to hear from him. But I spoke to Clarence's son, Troy, and he told me that after learning of the murders, his first thought had been that it had probably been Jeff Titus who did it, just because of how weird he was. And Troy told me that his dad had been scared of Jeff Titus. But I have wondered if Troy's memory here might have been colored by his knowledge of Jeff Titus's later arrest for the murders. Because it does seem somewhat at odds with Clarence Jones' statements to the newspaper, as well as the statements to the original investigators, in which he never suggested that he thought it might be Titus. In fact, in the beginning, not long after the murders, most of the rumors had to do with possible drug-related angles to the killings.
The police reports from both the original detectives and the cold case team detail all kinds of accusations that were flying around about possible suspects, some of which were wilder than others. Back before Jeff had been arrested anyway, people don't seem to have been that shy about sharing with the police their theories about who'd committed the murders. Now, in 2020, though, trying to investigate these reports about other suspects can be difficult, because a lot of the time the witnesses involved have now forgotten that they'd ever suspected anyone other than Jeff Titus might have been responsible for the murders. Or at least, they will say they have forgotten.
So he tried to change the topic. So he obviously totally told that and remember saying that. It's my read.
You think he does remember?
Oh, yeah, hell yeah.
So why would he not say it?
Because he's embarrassed. It makes him a snitch for one thing.
Everyone's happy that it was solved.
Once the guy who killed Jim Bennett and Doug Estes was arrested and put in prison, it makes sense that people would start to forget, or at least downplay, the existence of any suspicions they'd once had about their friends and neighbors. And besides, after Jeff was convicted, most of the talk about the case stopped anyway.
I ain't heard nothing lately here. I mean, it's kind of a hush-hush deal here. Now that they've solved it, they think they've solved it, whatever it is, I don't hear nothing about it anymore.
Back in 1990, most of the theories about what happened to Doug Estes and Jim Bennett had nothing to do with any territorial landowners. The most common theory was that the killings had a nexus in some way with the drug trade. Doug's cousin Gary Kremble has heard all those rumors, too.
Well, I remember through the grapevine there was discussion that, you know, it was drug-related and this thing and that thing, and I knew right off of that, ain't no way. These guys never knew each other. You know, see, I was living down Leonis. I lived outside of Comstock. I mean, I knew everybody. So, if you know, nah, them guys never knew each other, never met each other in their lives.
Yeah. Doug had connections to the drug trade in Comstock, while Jim grew marijuana down around Leonidas. For the most part, they were operating in different circles, though these circles did overlap at points. But even if Gary Kremble is right that Doug Estes and Jim Bennett didn't know one another, that by itself wouldn't exclude the possibility of the killings being drug-related. It would still be possible that one of the men was targeted and the other one was collateral damage. The possibility that either Doug Estes or Jim Bennett had been targeted because of their respective connections to the drug trade is something that the cold case detective Rich Madison thought was important to investigate.
And instead of him if he was truly just going out to hunt, why would he drive all the way up to Fulton State Gate? I think it was about a 15-minute drive from his house. And, you know, that just didn't make sense.
You're the first person I've spoken to who has said, oh, we were looking at Bennett. It seems like everyone else, the common line I hear is, Estes, we thought Estes was the target and Bennett was an accident, which I found kind of bizarre because to me it seems the other way.
It was strange that Jim Bennett had gone to the Fulton game area that day. All of his friends and family agree on that. It was not a place any of them would have expected him to go. In fact, many of them had been specifically advised by Jim not to go there. Too many crazies out there, he'd said. And it was also a little strange that he'd waited until so late in the afternoon to head out there in the first place. According to Jim's girlfriend, Kimber, he left the trailer that afternoon at 4:38 p.m. She glanced at the clock as he was heading out the door. That's only 40 minutes before sunset. Very late in the day to head out for a hunt. Not all members of the cold case team agree with Rich Madison, though, that any of the various drug theories were worth investigating. Cold case detective Mike Brown in particular does not believe it's possible that this crime could have been drug-related, because the shootings in the game area are not how a drug hit would have gone down.
Rich thought it was a dope deal, because the victims of the crime were dopers. They smoked grass and all that stuff, you know. And I used to work dope. I was one of the first undercover officers in Kalamazoo. I grew my hair long, and I used to work dope. So a doper, I'm telling you, I used to know the heart of a dope dealer back in those days. They're not going to put themselves at jeopardy at all. Nah, hell, they're not going into a field with a bunch of rednecks that have rifles, you know. They're going to shoot a guy on a shooter. That's what they're going to do.
Still, when Jim Bennett died, he'd had a decent amount of weed in storage on his property, far in excess of what could be described as personal use. And there are some unanswered questions about aspects of Jim's grow operation. Around town, there was nothing secret about the fact that Jim had been growing pot. Everyone knew that. But when Jacinda and Susan talked to Bennett's friend, Skeeter, he told them that he'd known that Jim Bennett had grown weed, but expressed surprise about the apparent scale of Jim Bennett's pot-growing operation.
I saw a lot of pot, more than I ever knew. She always asked Jim, you got any pot? I ain't got any.
Okay, so that's what I've been wondering about. He had what seems to me a ton of pot.
Right, that's what I don't get either. Where did he come up with all this pot? I know Jim grew a lot of places.
He had two freezers full of it.
Really?
That's news to you? That sounds like a lot to me. I don't.
Yes, it is. Right. Huh. Cheap ass.
Despite Skeeter's protests, none of this was actually news to him. From notes of his interviews with the police back in 1990 and 1991, Skeeter seems to have had a pretty good grasp of the scale of Jim's weed operation. A few months after the murders, he contacted the police to give them more details about Bennett's operation and who his business partner was. The notes of the interview with Skeeter read, quote, Terry and Jim were in business together. Jim grew in house under lights, knew he had at least 100 plants and cups and transplanted around. Terry would sell it out of state, etc. Terry had been bragging about having pot in Sherwood, trying to trade pot for cocaine, 100 pounds. And Skeeter knows exactly who the Terry in these notes refers to.
Do you ever hear about anyone else? Like, might have?
No. I mean, I was.
What about Terry Esch?
Terry Esch. Oh, yeah. Terry Esch and Jim did grow together, grew pot together.
When Terry Esch had first been interviewed by investigators, about a month after the murders, he claimed at first that he hadn't even seen Jim Bennett in over 3 years. Though he then quickly acknowledged that he'd seen Jim a few days before he died, when they happened to run into one another at a bar. But other than that, Terry insisted they weren't in contact with one another at all. He explained that he and Jim had had a falling out over a failed business venture. See, we were going to build windmills together, but we never did because nothing was ever perfect enough for Jim. I'm still going to build them. I'm just going to build them simpler. They don't have to be 198% efficient like they always had to be with Jim. Everything had to be perfect. As a result, Terry said, they really hadn't been around one another in years. None of that matches up with what others and Leonidas say, though. P. People thought that Terry and Jim Bennett had still been close, and Terry had been a pallbearer at Jim's funeral. And Terry had become a frequent target of suspicion after Jim was murdered. It was all the usual kind of stuff, like the business partner who told detectives that on the night Jim Bennett died, Terry had told him he'd taken care of some business and he wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. And the tips that were called in about a particularly successful marijuana field Terry had been growing to the east of town, a big one worth at least $1 million, that had gotten raided around the same time Jim Bennett had been killed. And also a number of witnesses who told investigators that Terry seemed to know too much about the murders.
The original detectives had checked into these various leads, but nothing had ever shook out from it. When Jacinda and I went to talk to Terry Esch, he'd acknowledged that he and Jim Bennett had been good friends. And yes, they'd hung out together often. He didn't try to claim, like he had back in 1990, that he and Jim Bennett had stopped being friends years before. Though he did say that when Jim died, he'd actually been real mad at him at the time. Nothing to do with windmills, though. Apparently, they'd been building sheds together out of roofs from RVs, and Terry thought Jim had somehow stiffed him on a deal. Anyway, when I'd asked him about the marijuana field that had been busted around the same time that Jim had died, Terry Esch knew right away what I was talking about. That field hadn't been his, he told me. Oh, sure, he'd gotten arrested after a surveillance camera had filmed him on a motorcycle driving up to check on the field, but that didn't mean the field was his. It was some big-time professional operation, he thought, worth about $1 million. Terry Esch said he'd spotted it while driving around town, and he'd only stopped there so he could check out what the competition was up to. But he told us the same thing that he told the detectives back in 1990 about him and Jim growing weed together. That had never happened, he said. Terry Esch had been happy to describe some of his own grow operations from back in the day, but he was insistent that that had been his own thing. He and Jim Bennett had never grown together. In fact, it was a personal policy of his to never grow weed with friends. That way, he said, when you get ripped off, you don't suspect your best friend. I asked him then, if he and Jim had never grown together, why were there people who were saying otherwise? Well, he said, it's all about divide and conquer. By spreading little rumors everywhere.
Most of the theories in this case about how the killings have been drug-related aren't actually about Jim Bennett, though. More often, these theories focus on Doug Estes. Over the years, there have been a number of people who have come forward with claims that Doug Estes had been the target of a drug-related hit. Doug, they say, had gotten caught up in a bad drug deal and was killed because of it. Jim Bennett had just been collateral damage.
Well, there was also motive on the Estes side. There's a family by the name of Middleton that are kind of legendary idiots that live in Comstock. And they were druggies, and they would sell it if they had it, kind of a thing. And information was that Larry Middleton, Estes, had fronted Larry a pretty good quantity of cocaine to sell for a profit, then Estes would make a profit. Well, the information was that Larry took the coke, sold it, and went to Florida on vacation. So there was a Hispanic family in Comstock who were the supplier, who were part, that's how, it was a complicated thing, who were part of the Mexican cartel mafia organization in Chicago that used to front this family and would front Estes, who was a longtime friend of theirs, and he would distribute some for money and pay them.
There were people who were known to have had disputes with Doug Estes. But at least according to Bobby Brown, none of those disputes were of the sort that could have risen to the level of causing someone to put a hit out on him. And anyway, even if there had been someone who had wanted to kill Doug Estes, Bobby doesn't think it could have been in any way related to his death.
I know everyone looked at like the drug angle because, you know, Doug's history and Jim's history. And did you guys ever think he, like, Did you ever think that was possible? Like, he had made someone mad, or he owed money, or he...
No, because we didn't know where we was going.
Right.
We didn't know where he was going, so I knew no one followed us. They had been good to do that. And I was sitting in the middle. I could see the rearview mirrors in my face.
You would have noticed.
Yeah.
Even if someone had wanted to kill Doug Estes, they wouldn't have been able to kill him at the Fulton game area, because no one would have known to find him there. Even Doug Estes hadn't known that's where he was going to end up that afternoon. Though there is one witness who says this isn't entirely true. According to one of the witnesses at Titus's trial, there actually had been someone who knew Doug Estes was going to the game area that day, because Doug Estes had told him he'd be there.
So you knew he was going to be at the Fulton State game area?
Well, he came and asked me if I wanted to go.
Okay.
And the next, you know, next morning when it came time to go, I said, no, I'm just going to stay here. Well, Bobby said, I'll go, because Bobby had been staying with me. And Bobby said, I'll go instead. I said, cool, go ahead. I didn't want Doug to go by himself.
That's Norberto Agonesis, though most people know him just by his nickname, Nerve. He was a neighbor of Doug Estes and Bobby Brown. And actually, at the time of the murders, Bobby had been living over at Norberto's house. And Norberto says Doug had been in debt to him, though Doug had been doing his best to pay it off.
He borrowed cash to pay somebody at the time. I didn't know who it was. I didn't care.
Uh-huh.
You know, and he borrowed a lot. But when it went down to the end, like I said, he brought it down to a couple $100. I really wasn't even worried about that. It already went, you know, past my mind. Now, these other guys, they weren't so friendly, the coke dealers and stuff.
But, according to Norberto, this Larry Middleton thing, or whatever the issue was that Doug Estes had found himself in, that had all gotten worked out somehow.
I thought he had borrowed the money from me to pay for that.
So that's what it was?
That's what I thought.
I knew. So it seems like he may have fixed the problem, but there was a problem.
There was a problem.
So
I will admit that he borrowed money from me to solve a problem. But that's the only thing I'm admitting. I don't know what the problem was.
That's what I'm guessing. So you think the problem was fixed? As far as you know, the problem got fixed.
As far as I know, that part of the problem got fixed.
According to how Norberto remembers it, Doug Estes had other problems, though, that he'd not yet been able to fix. And he'd had people who might have had reason to be out to get him.
Agonesis? Yeah, he was connected with the Reyes family, R-E-Y-E-S. And the information was... Agonesis told me this himself. But he had a criminal history that, you know, they would have, but they didn't even try. I mean, if he had gotten up on a stand, if they went that way in the investigation, you know, they would butcher him.
I'm still very confused by Norberto Agonesis, because he has an inexplicable story about having known where Estes was going that day to hunt, and that he is supposed to go with them. And I'm like, why would you admit to this? No one else knows where Estes is going. And he's like, oh, and Bobby says it didn't happen that way. There's no other evidence it happened that way, and yet he's jumping up and saying, oh yeah, I knew. Like, is he wanting attention? You're shaking your head now.
I don't think it was for attention. I mean, he didn't jump up and say, hey, you know, I kind of looked him up. And he was running a pawn shop at the time. And, you know, he had nothing to gain.
Norberto truly had nothing to gain by telling the story. He was essentially saying that, yeah, there were people who wanted to kill Doug Estes, but they could have only done so if Norberto had helped them do it. And by talking about the case, Norberto had caused himself plenty of headaches over the years, and it's why he ended up getting subpoenaed to testify at Jeff Titus's trial.
No, not when they just come and grab me up, man. I was like, what is this? They said, this is called coming and taking you to court. Willingly, unwillingly,
did you
we
stay
have
over...
a court order to take you to court.
Did you stay overnight, or did you just stay like...
They took me to the jail, put me in a cell, brought me out of there to go to court, took me back to the cell, and I can't remember if I had to stay overnight or not, but anyway, later on, they took me back home. But, oh no, wait a minute, I had to find my own way home after court. Yeah, they just let me out, told me, there you go.
It wasn't the prosecution that had subpoenaed Norberto Agonesis, though. It was Jeff Titus's defense attorneys who did. Because one of the stories Norberto had told the cold case team had been about how, on the day of the murders, when Doug and Bobby had invited him to go with them to the Fulton game area, well, it wasn't because they were going to hunt. The whole deer hunting thing had just been a ruse. They were actually going to the game area to steal Jim Bennett's marijuana crop. Because according to Norberto, Bobby Brown's uncle had been very familiar with Jim Bennett. They did business together. That's how Bobby's uncle had known where they could find Bennett's marijuana in the first place. Actually, Norberto told the detectives he'd personally known Jim Bennett as well. And Bobby Brown must have known him too, because Jim Bennett had come by Norberto's house a few times while Bobby was there. Either Jeff Titus's defense attorneys believed all of this, or they thought the jury would, so this story from Norberto became one of the defense strategies at trial.
You were present during his testimony?
I think so, yes.
And he was saying that he believed that Doug Estes and Bobby Brown came to his house that morning and said, hey, you want to go hunting with us? But really it was because they wanted to go steal Jim Bennett's marijuana crop.
Yeah, because there was a crop planted down there earlier because the police found it, I think, that year. But there was I found when I was down there one time hunting, the boxes with all the red Solo cups in it where they had all the marijuana plant.
Yeah, so I mean, they brought up in trial this idea that that Doug was going over there to steal Jim Bennett's crop.
But in November, I don't think the crops would have been out. They would have already picked them because you would have had a chance of a frost. See, they want to pick them green.
Jeff Titus is right. Even though Titus's attorneys tried to float this whole theory that the murders had really been some kind of complicated marijuana heist gone wrong, the timing for it all just doesn't work. By November, the marijuana plants would have been removed from all the fields and swamps where it had gotten secreted away. Because by November, if the cold and frost hadn't already gotten the crop, then the deer hunters would have picked clean whatever was left when they came across the crop while out looking for deer. And there's another problem with this whole drug heist theory. For Doug Estes to have been going to the Fulton game area to steal Bennett's weed, Bennett's weed would have actually had to been there in the game area.
Do you know if he ever grew in the Fulton State game area?
I don't think he'd be that dumb. You know, people would go there.
There's no evidence that Jim Bennett ever grew in the game area or stored his marijuana there while it was drying. There's also no evidence that Norberto and Jim Bennett had even known one another. And now, in 2020, Norberto seems to have entirely forgotten that he ever claimed to know Jim Bennett in the first place.
Did you know Jim Bennett?
No.
Okay.
I didn't know him at all.
The other guy?
I didn't know none of them.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't know any of them.
For his part, Bobby Brown denies that any part of the marijuana heist story is true. He didn't know Jim Bennett, didn't know about any marijuana in the Fulton game area, and doesn't know why Norberto would say otherwise.
I don't know why he says that, but he does.
I don't know why he says that either. I don't know why.
At least he admits now that Bennett, he didn't know, and he had no way of knowing Bennett.
If believed, though, Norberto Againes' story would make Bobby Brown a potential suspect in the case. And even before Norberto came forward, there were people who'd questioned his own involvement in the case. That's something Bobby himself is very aware of, even now.
So, do the cops ever clear you? Do you ever feel like you're no longer a suspect?
No.
Yeah.
I still don't.
Still?
I still think there's people that think I did that.
Like who?
No one in particular, just maybe it's just me, I don't know.
Right after the murders occurred, when Detective Wiersma first began his investigation, Bobby Brown had been an immediate person of interest in the case, for obvious reasons.
Largest percentage of homicides are committed by people you know or family members. Generally, that's kind of where you start.
So in the beginning, who you're looking at is the stepson, because he was there with him.
Yes.
From the beginning, Bobby was on the detective's radar. And at first, Bobby had been cooperative. He'd given a written statement, answered the detective's questions, and had returned with them to the crime scene the following day to show them what all had happened. But later on, when Wersamon Ballot had needed to do a second, longer interview with Bobby, he became less cooperative. To Bobby, it felt like he was now a suspect in the murder of his stepfather. He was angry and upset, and to some, his reaction seemed questionable, even suspicious. And of course, Norberto, who has a story about everything, has a story about Bobby, too.
So wherever you were, was Bobby living there, too?
On and off, yes.
Why was he living with you?
He wasn't getting along with Doug.
Okay.
Him and Doug were having bad issues about something. I guess Bobby had done something that he didn't care for.
But as far as Detective Wersamo was concerned, Bobby had been a suspect by default, due to the fact that he was a family member and present at the scene. But it never went further than that. He never found anything to make Bobby, in his mind, a serious suspect.
You said he was hesitant to take a polygraph. Why do you think he was hesitant to take a polygraph? Or did that strike you as odd, or is that standard? Or?
Well, Robert Brown, is a child of the streets. And I'm sure he's heard all the stories about polygraphs. I think he distrusted the idea of taking a polygraph and comes from that type of a family where they would have distrust.
Eventually, Bobby gave in and submitted to the polygraph.
So, do you think the cops keep hassling me after that?
Yeah, they did. They followed me around, put cards on, and I just turned into alcoholics. All that did, they just put cards on the door constantly, and I was avoiding them. And I would say I wasn't.
Are there notes, or they just put the card in the door?
Their card. Just a little badge in the door.
Just a reminder that they're watching?
They wanted to talk to me. I knew I had warrants. I didn't want to talk to them. Warrants for probably stupid shit, driving without a license, whatever. He's like, I'm not worried about the warrants. My dad's like, you need to get a hold of them detectives. They're driving me nuts. So I called him. I'm like, well, what's up? He's like, you need to come. Why don't you take this polygraph test? He's like, I'm not worried about your warrants. I don't give a shit about that. He's like, that's not why I want to see you. Just come down here. And we'll get it. So I told my dad, well, see you later. We're going to turn myself in. Walk down here. And,
like literally right, walk across the street.
Yeah, walk down here. And he, you know, that, he didn't say that I flunked it or anything. He just said some stuff wasn't jiving. Or I don't remember how exactly he put it, but... I felt my ears get hot, like, I couldn't believe what he was saying. I was thinking, you son of a bitch. Like, you know I didn't do this shit, why are you saying this? And my dad told me when all that stuff happened, he told me, pay attention to what they're saying, because they like to put words in your mouth. And he wasn't lying.
Bobby isn't wrong, though, about there being people who think of him as a suspect in this case. In the years after the murders, but before Jeff Titus's eventual arrest, a lot of those silent observer tips that were called in had been called in about Bobby. There was nothing of real note, just people insinuating that Bobby was not acting right after the murders, or making claims that could never be corroborated that he'd confessed to the crime. And there were people who simply felt that having Bobby Brown be the culprit was the tidiest solution to the mystery of the murders at the Fulton Game area.
They said the case was all about, in the first place, when it all aspired and they got out on the news. But originally somebody said they thought it was over like a drug deal or something. But the one guy, his nephew was with him, wasn't they?
I think
it was Jim Bennett and Doug Estes.
Yeah.
One of their nephew was out there with him, and they thought he might have done it.
Oh, his stepson. Doug's stepson, yeah. Yeah.
That's what it is.
There just isn't any evidence that's what happened, though. Bobby has always been consistent about what happened that day, and his story is consistent with the other evidence. There just isn't any theory of his guilt that I can make add up in any sort of plausible way. Still, if someone had wanted to make a case against Bobby Brown, there was enough material there to work with to shape the evidence into a narrative about a troubled kid who took advantage of an opportunity to get even with his angry stepdad that he wanted to be rid of. That's the kind of narrative the jury might find appealing anyway. And if the cold case team had begun its investigation by deciding that Bobby Brown, rather than Jeff Titus, was their lead suspect, well, it's possible they would have had equal success in winning a conviction. Jeff Titus had also heard all these rumors about how the murders were supposedly some kind of drug deal gone wrong. Because at the beginning, that's what everyone had been saying. So when he spoke about the murders, which was often, he would describe them in those terms.
Some of the detectives say you put yourself behind bars because of the things you said after the murders. You know, like, I would have killed those guys. They got what they deserved.
Well, I look at drug dealers as the root of all evil. Because of them, you have shootings, you have robberies, you have everything going on because guys are stealing to get drugs. Then I'll have no qualms about that. Because everything I see is related to drugs, is them doing stuff to get their drugs. They don't care what they do, what they take, who they hurt, or anything.
Wait, are you saying you would have no qualms about shooting a drug dealer?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't shoot them, no. They want to kill themselves, all fine, well, and good. Like I say, was another drug dealer killed them because they were dealing drugs? That's between the drug dealers.
Jeff, the things that people say you said, right? This is where I get hung up.
Jeff often seems to be unaware that others can find his statements to be uncomfortable or even shocking. And from what Kelly Warren remembers from that day in line out at Fort Custer, it's not hard to see why at Jeff Titus's trial there were people like Dan Israels who came forward to testify that Titus had made statements that, in their view, were incriminating. Or at least had an incriminating subtext.
Why were they upset, do you think, the couple?
Pardon me?
Why was the couple upset?
I think just because they felt it was so, unfeeling for the two people who had died.
Like the way Jeff was talking was kind of callous.
Yeah. But that wasn't his intention. He wasn't talking about the two guys. He was talking about the cops being incompetent in the sense that
they didn't find a gun.
For a lot of the weird stuff that Jeff has been accused of saying, Jeff will readily admit that he did in fact say those things. For instance, there was another rumor about Jeff that was of particular concern to the cold case team once they'd gotten their warrant to do a search in Jeff's property. And as Jeff acknowledges, this rumor came directly from Jeff himself.
I mean, it's just like I said, I told people, I said, my house is wired. You break into my house, I'll be picking up your body parts.
What?
Because I lived in the country. I didn't have no burglar alarm or nothing. It'd be easy just to pull up in my yard and rip me off and steal everything. But we never had a problem.
Was it actually booby-trapped?
No.
You just said it was?
I just said it was. Everybody knew that I went to, I talked about it. I've been to mine warfare and demolition school in the military and stuff.
So you were putting out the story that you had a booby trap, but you never had a booby trap.
My house was booby trapped. If you broke in, I'd be picking up your body parts.
But you actually never did that to your property?
No, I didn't do it to my property.
Okay. So it was a combination. You would say that you had, people knew you had the experience, they believed you.
Yeah.
But you didn't even have an alarm system.
No. But no one ever bothered the house. And we lived there for over 10 years.
Well, you can't argue with results, I guess. But Jeff's rhetorical security system is the kind of thing that will get people talking. And talk they did. The cold case detectives are likely right. Jeff Titus probably did put himself behind bars because of the things he said after the murders. Rumors don't solve cases. If they did, this case would have been solved within a week, a month tops, given all the rumors that investigators had to work with. In one of the early interviews in this case, there's an exchange where the witness asks the detective, "Don't it suck to think that a lot of what you hear is rumors?" Yep, the detective answers, It is a bitch. You don't know where to take it, not when you hear so much. One of the reasons for that, for why there were so many rumors in this case, may be because of what was being offered in exchange for them.
My uncle and I, my uncle had a $10,000 reward out because we knew who did it. We knew it was Jim Titus, and he put, my uncle would put posters of Doug with a $10,000 reward. We'd come by there the next week and be shot full of holes. And we went through, my uncle dropped me. He wasn't able to walk very well, and so we went to, I put in like wanted posters, Union City, Athens, Leonidas, Minden, Vicksburg, you know, everywhere.
Rumors usually do just fine moving under their own power, but the offer of a reward can certainly give them an extra kick. And if there were any hunters out there who'd been threatened by Jeff Titus while in the game area, they could have made themselves an easy buck by calling in to report it. None did, though. But even if rumors didn't solve this case, after Jeff Titus' arrest, they do seem to have helped solidify the community's conviction and his guilt. All the rumors about everyone else begin to be forgotten, while all the rumors about Jeff Titus start being taken as the gospel. I've spoken to plenty of people in Kalamazoo and beyond who've never heard of any of the evidence that was actually offered against Titus at his trial. And yet they are certain of his guilt and feel strongly about it. Before we talked to Gary Kremble, Jacinda and I hadn't known that he'd been involved in putting out any of the posters around town. And we weren't certain which set of posters he was referring to. There have been a few different ones in this case. But there is one that went up during the original investigation that offers a $10,000 reward. At the top of that poster, there's a photo of Doug Estes. He's shaggy-haired and smiling broadly at the camera. And below that, the text reads, "Do you know who killed this man? You may have the missing piece of information. Please help." Jacinda pulled up a picture of this poster to confirm with Gary Kremble that this is the one he meant.
Yeah, that's the one I'd seen.
Is that the same one you guys put up?
That's my buddy, Doug. Me and my brother liked to took that guy out in the woods and just strapped him up to a tree and skinned that sorry fucker alive.
The posters that Gary Kremble helped put up around Fulton and the surrounding area, the ones offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to an arrest, did not ultimately generate any leads about Jeff Titus. Nor did any of the tips called in about any of the other suspects in this case ever lead to an arrest. 10 years later, when the cold case team reopened the investigation, they decided to give the reward posters one more try, though. This time, the reward amount was smaller. They were only offering $5,000 now, down from the previous 10, but the cold case team went with a more targeted approach. They printed out hundreds of flyers that stated investigators had developed intelligence that suggested a specific perpetrator of the double homicide and were now seeking information about him. Although the flyers did not identify Jeff Titus by name, from context, those flyers left little doubt about who it was that the investigators were hoping to get information about.
You knew the flyers were about you.
What?
You knew the flyers were about you.
Yeah. Because they were at the VA, they were in Athens, and they were in my guard unit.
Yeah, so it didn't take a whole lot to figure that out.
And like I say, the guard unit said, "Titus, we've been ordered to put this out because you're a suspect in this, and we want you to turn around and explain it to the guys before we put it out."
So they had you.
What I did.
They had you pass the flyers out to your own.
Yeah. They had all they had in the formation. They said these flyers are coming out, and they asked me to explain it, and that's what I did in the formation.
And then, of course, those people turn around, they're like, "That's so weird. I'm going to the police right now. This guy's so, like, has so much hubris that he thinks he can just pass out the flyers himself."
Yeah.
The cold case team's strategy worked. Once those flyers went out, the calls from Jeff Titus' co-workers started pouring in. Next time on Undisclosed.
A And thanks for listening to episode 8 of Undisclosed, The State versus Jeff Titus. We're back next Monday with episode 9, and don't forget to send us your questions for this week's addendum on Thursday.
Amit Lotelhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production was done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and host of the Crime Writers On podcast. And music from this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for episodes are available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. They're brought to you by our amazing transcript team, Don Logus, Britta Bliss, Skylar Park, and Eric Fladell. And of course, thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online, and on all social media, our handle is at UndisclosedPod. We're at Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.